Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and I'm joined today for the first time by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you, John.
Three days in. Got through the IT hell?
Yes, just.
Megan Boxall, how are you doing, Megan?
I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. You've had a nice holiday like I have.
I'm actually not very good. I'm still slightly depressed.
Sitting on holiday. Depressed from being out of Suffolk.
I am, yes. And I'm thinking about what I was doing this time last week.
I've
already run you through day-to-day of Suffolk.
Thank you very much. And over the control room, Alex Newman. So as Phil joins us in the office, Alex, you're leaving us.
Yeah, he's kicking me out in a way.
Is he having your chair? Oh, that's a point.
Oh, the scramble begins.
The scramble begins, yes. Alex, you're off to Spain, but you're going to continue working for the magazine.
Yes.
Covering oil and gas and mining, which we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
In fact, I think mining is probably a good place to start because there's been quite a few results this week.
Yeah, it remains busy and we're not even into the AIM mining season, which the half year reporting calendar is slightly pushed back for the smaller end of the market. So there's going to be a flurry, I imagine, towards the end of September as well.
I can't wait. But this week we've had South32, which is a reasonably big player.
Yeah, they are really big. They're kind of I've talked about them being one of the underdogs of the large diversified miners. I think because they were spun out of BHP, they've always been sort of seen in the shadow of the really, really big giants. And also they were spun out of BHP sort of with the view that the assets they had were the kind of the secondary unwanted commodities that BHP wasn't going to focus on. But they've actually held up pretty well.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of love for this company when it was spun out.
No.
I've got a friend who works out for BHP out in the US, and they were given South32 shares, and I think they felt it was something not worth having. But they've done all right, actually.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. So they floated in 2015. There was still a little bit to go before the commodities, you know, rout really, really hit, which it sort of bottomed at the beginning of 2016. But my view on South32 has been for the last couple of years. I mean, they're not as spectacular in some of their plans, or they don't have quite the quality of assets of for example a Rio Tinto or a BHP. But that said, they were sort of forged in the depths of the commodity market, and it's given them some, at least their strategic outlook is quite conservative in some ways. That's, I think, you know, they've been ahead of the game and ahead of some of their larger peers.
So what is their approach? I mean, what are they doing that kind of is allowing them to deliver, I mean, decent dividends for one thing?
Yeah, good dividends. So, and they, you know, they started the buyback trail ahead of Rio Tinto. They've also invested. They've also started investing ahead of some of their peers. So if you look at Rio, BHP, they're still divesting a lot of their assets. South32 is already thinking about the next stretch of their growth. So they bought this asset, Arizona Mining, this year. At the time, some analysts were saying that, you know, that it's slightly top evaluation. They paid something like 50% premium for the company. But I mean, at some point, they and their peers are going to have to invest in the future. I mean, at the moment, one of the criticisms I think you could level against Rio Tinto is that it's just a fire sale almost of their assets. And, you know, it's good that they're out of coal, for example, but questions do remain over whether the next leg of growth is going to come.
And what particular commodities is South32 focused on?
So they're big in alumina and aluminium and manganese. And actually the last couple of years, one of the big stories in the commodity world is the world of metals is that steel has held up very, very well. And, you know, a lot of the commodities they supply play into that narrative. Also, coke and coal as well, that they have these high quality assets in Australia. So in many ways they've survived the brunt of the copper price hit in recent months. And they're very conservative in how they manage their capital. I think in some ways they're unloved, but undeservedly so compared to some of their giant peers.
So we're saying buy.
Yeah, we've said it's a sort of income themed buy for the last couple of years.
Okay, you mentioned that Rio Tinto is in disposal mode.
Yes.
Another result this week, Anglo Pacific is kind of a beneficiary of that trend.
Yeah, a nice segue in there. So Anglo Pacific is a mining royalty company. It's quite interesting. There's not many mining royalty companies which don't focus on either silver or gold worldwide. They've been a benefit from Rio Tinto's disposal program in two ways. First, the Kestrel mine, which Rio Tinto sold earlier this year. The new owners are planning to double production, which will essentially mean a much higher royalty take for Anglo Pacific. They have a royalty on a tenement which is currently being mined at the Kestrel mine.
So they're essentially buying stakes in these companies.
Yeah. So they'll either take a like a net smelter a royalty, or they or just a revenue. A bulk revenue royalty. So generally the way they do business is they will look to buy something ahead of cash in 2 years ahead of cash flows coming, and then get the sort of dividend upside then, which they then pass on to their shareholders. And the second way they may be benefiting from Rio Tinto's disposal program is that Rio recently flagged that they may want to sell their Canadian iron ore business. And Anglo Pacific has just acquired a stake in another royalty company based in Canada, which has a royalty on this iron ore business. The valuation, which some have already ascribed to a potential IPO of Rio Tinto's Canadian iron ore business, is far in excess of the amount they paid for the shares in this sort of flow through royalty business. So another potential benefit for Anglo Pacific there.
Well, the results look nice. It appears to be working, and yeah. And we're positive.
Yeah, we are positive, and that, you know. One of the attractive things, I think, you know, if you're interested in getting some sort of some commodity exposure, is that they don't have any of, or a lot less of the mining risk that comes with similar companies of their size. And if you're interested in getting exposure to commodities and a dividend, they, I think, are a better play than you know, many of the companies in the space.
Okay, well, let's go quickly to the news section. Yeah. You've written an interesting piece here this week. It's a company that I haven't heard us write about for a long, long time. In fact, this was the first company we ever did a video on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Martin Lee went out to Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah.
and took some footage, which I turned into a little video. Charak Gold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still going.
Still going. Still not producing anything yet.
I mean, this we're talking like 7 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting company. They have a sort of all-star board. One of their NEDs is a former Goldman Sachs global commodities head. Their chief executive now is the former chief executive of EN Plus Group, former advisors to the Russian government on their privatization. So they've always promised a lot, and, you know, they continue to refer to themselves as the next leading emerging markets gold company. You know, that obviously they're in a good company there, because lots of small gold companies refer to themselves in similar terms.
Mm.
But yeah, they finally look like they're about to start producing, and they are planning to raise up to $100 million by way of a convertible debt issuance. That's going to go some way to buying this unnamed asset in a former Soviet republic.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds dubious.
Oh, well, yeah. If that's, yeah, I mean, that's often the charge levelled against anyone doing business in you know, former Soviet republics. But I'm slightly less. Well, I always think if you compare some gold companies in Russia or the former Soviet states to Africa, I think the risk premium is often quite a bit higher for Russian stocks. I mean, there are reasons for that, but. But I think sometimes unduly so. We'll have to wait to be seen with Charak Gold, though. I mean, there's not enough in what they've announced so far to, I think, for shareholders to take a proper view on.
We'll have to dig that video out again. You'll have to get out there, Alex.
Yeah.
You're our roving reporter.
Well, Spain is a little bit closer to Kyrgyzstan. Actually, maybe it isn't. I'm not sure.
No, probably not.
No.
It's still miles away, and you have to drive over a mountain to get there.
Yeah.
Which looked terrifying. The footage was terrifying.
Yeah.
Wow. Martin Lee, intrepid Martin Lee. Megan, let's turn to you. Thank you, Alex. Your big result this week was IQE. Yeah. Now, IQE is a fascinating company because this has been I don't know, it's one that you've got a view on, Phil.
You've got a view on it,
well,
too.
Well, I don't understand it.
This is my problem with it as well.
But, I mean, the share price has been... It rocketed up a couple of years back, and then it started to come down with a bump.
People,
what on earth is going on?
People have got very excited about IQ in the last few years because they may or may not have a contract with Apple. They do have a contract with Apple, but they can't say they have a contract. It's not actually with Apple, it's with the supplier which provides Apple's, well, the iPhone's face recognition software.
So, I mean, they make wafers. And wafers are kind of the building blocks of chips.
Yeah. So they're a teeny weeny component of a chip which makes one part of a mobile phone work. And they've done this for such a long time. It's not like this is a new technology. IQE has been around for a very, very long time. And in that time, it's done nothing apart from last year when it was able to say that it had a big new contract with a facial recognition company. And with only one mobile phone on the market using facial recognition, it was pretty clear that that was an Apple product, which was very exciting.
I don't quite understand why. I mean, facial recognition is a bit of software. They're a bit of hardware. And I kind of... I've reached the limits of my technological understanding as to why their technology is so important for facial recognition.
Well, there is... Hardware is important for... Facial recognition does rely on a piece of hardware.
The speed at which you can do the processing, presumably.
Yeah.
Right.
And it does rely on that chunk of hardware which is made by IQE. But there are other companies out there which can do this. IQE says it's the best. But if it says it's the best and it's been around for 25 years, why is it still building out its manufacturing plant? This is what I don't understand about this company.
I mean, what I will say is it's not a small company. I mean, it is.
No, it's not. It's a big company.
780 million market cap, even after the shares have come off quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's doing 70 million turnover at the half year, which is a pretty chunky. Mm-hmm. Pretty chunky amount of revenue. So there is something here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just how you value it.
It's not a complete blue sky situation. But the problem I have with this company is that it got all this massive following who, I mean, a lot of them did not like our analysis in the winter time this year. There were some incredibly aggressive comments on our article because people were really passionate about this company for a little while. But then it seems to have died off a bit now that actually people have come to realise that yes, this does have an exciting piece of technology, but there are other companies which have it too. And the numbers were fine, but they don't justify 31 times forward earnings.
Indeed. There is a limit to how much you should value this company at. I mean, Phil, I know you've got... We spoke earlier about, you know, what we see sometimes in the market when it comes to these... companies with an exciting story and how they get ramped.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are a lot of story stocks out there, and it's like... Let's have the sort of instant gratification from owning it straight away and sort of get rich quick type attitude. And then let's see what happens. That's the way, you know, some of these stocks tend to pan out. You know, it's like buy the story and then see if the story stacks up later on.
I think what Megan's alluding to there, which I think is quite interesting, is that it's the story that's being bought into. And when you start to probe into that, into the veracity of that story, it upsets people.
I just think with this company, I mean, I've not looked at it as much as Megan or others have, but you know what I have looked at, it is, you know, you need to be pretty savvy to sort of get to the bottom of what's going on with this company, and not just in terms of what it does, but where the numbers are moving around, particularly things like the cash flow statement. I mean, the cash flows of this company seem to be all over the place, and that always can be a potential red flag that something perhaps is not what it should be. And again, you know, you come back to the valuation, you know, look at the valuations being put on it. You know, any share that's got, you know, a multiple of more than 30 times earning, you know, you're paying for a lot up front.
Yeah. And actually, in fact, quickly turning to Algie Hall's stock screen this week, which is about, he calls them British disruptors.
Yeah.
But among them are some very, very, I mean, what would you say? Blue sky companies.
Yeah.
But there is something there, but the valuations being asked of them are extraordinary. Yeah. Blue Prism is one of them that we've looked at quite a bit.
But Blue Prism, I get the Blue Prism story more than I get IQE. I mean, I still don't get Blue Prism.
But it's still a story.
It's a story which is, this is a futuristic technology which we're not using at the moment. What IQE is doing is something that has been done in the world for quite a long time. Hardware, chips, wafers, semiconductors... This technology has been around for a while, and there are a lot of companies which are a lot bigger than IQE which can do it as well.
I guess the point is people get excited for this, the whiff of a contract with someone like
Apple. With Apple, yeah. And, I mean, I would argue that that can be slightly concerning. There's a history of companies in the UK which have been buckled by contracts with Apple.
Imagination.
And their reliance on one contract, I don't think that's a good thing. Although saying that, these numbers did show that actually they're not as reliant on Apple as we may have feared. They do have partnerships with a lot of other companies. They're saying that this photonics, which is what it's called, it's using visual to create technology, is is a rapidly growing market and it could be very exciting. And there's a lot of people in that field now, not just Apple. But I still think that, I mean...
So we're kind of neutral. We're on the fence here.
I mean, I'm negative. Our hold is like hold off.
Weak hold.
It's not hold on. It's we've said sell. We've said get out of this. And we said sell at the top. It was actually Alex who made the call. We had a very good buy tip and we said sell. And since then we've said don't jump back in because we rode the story and now the story is over.
Mm.
So it's still just the same, boring, steady as she goes, which shouldn't be. If you're a tech company, you shouldn't be steady as she goes. You should be doing cool stuff.
You need the building blocks. I think it's a nice company. I just think people get carried away with these stories sometimes.
They got carried away for sure over the last couple of years. But then also the short sellers came in as well, and there were all these questions about its accounting. And I agree with Phil, it's very hard to read what's going on at IQE, which is why I think people got a bit sensitive about what was going on, because the accounts are really, really tough to wade through, which also I don't think is a great sign.
And not for a smaller company.
It's not a great sign. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's something untoward going on.
No.
But I think one of the things that's disappointed shareholders in this company or potential investors, I think they want the company to be, you know, to come out and be more upfront and say, look, this is why it's happening. This is why the numbers are what they are. And I think that, yeah, they've tried to do that, but maybe they haven't gone far enough.
Mm.
Whether that's because they don't want to reveal anything, you know, from a competitive point of view, I don't know, but it just doesn't tend to sit well.
Yeah, it is one of those funny industries where often things are not revealed to investors because
I think
of commercial.
So many
interests.
Layers of contract as well. They've got this contract with someone who is supplying Apple. They may not even be supplying Apple. Their contract. Their contract may be with someone else who then is supplying Apple. There may be so many layers of contract in there.
Well, that kind of makes sense because I thought Apple doesn't make chips.
No,
yet,
it doesn't. It doesn't make
and
chips.
And therefore, if it was,
so there's definitely at least one layer between IQE and Apple. But how many layers that is, I don't know. And so I can see why they can't be that transparent, but also they could make their accounting clearer, and it's not clear at all. It's very jumpy all over the page, and it's not easy to read.
No. Well, that's why we've got you here now, Phil, because you are an expert at getting beneath the skin of accounts. That's kind of what you do.
I try to.
You try
don't,
to.
Don't always,
you're
get, too don't modest, always get it right, but I try.
You're too modest. Well, I mean, you've written a book about how you do this.
Yeah.
And presumably buying into exciting stories is not your number one piece of advice.
I mean, that, you know, I think the whole thing about this investing game is that there are several ways that you can try and make money. And I don't think, you know, I think you've, it's all about finding one that works for you. And, you know, my kind of way is looking at stuff which you can have more confidence in because the companies are, you know, they've been around for a longer period of time, they've delivered, they've proven, and hopefully they can keep on doing that. They've got more to give. And it's all about, you know, like everything, it's all about trading off, you know, risk and reward. You know, you can buy early stage companies for what look like very high valuations, and they can make you a lot of money, but they can also lose you a lot of money.
Yeah, I know. This is what I've personally always struggled with. Something like Fevertree is a great example.
Yeah,
I mean, when that first hit the scenes, you know, hit our radar, I was kind of like, really? Tonic? Yeah. And I was so wrong. But you know, but also there was no track record to really go on at that point. But so I much prefer the kind of whole boring approach. But I will be losing out on these mega gains that Fevertree investors would have got.
Fevertree, you know, you look at Fevertree, and it is an outstanding business. You know, from the product it sells, you know that people like the product. It's tapping into a theme of premiumization of spirits. And, you know, you look at the numbers, the profitability, it doesn't need to invest a lot of money, and it makes stonking big profits.
So your book is called How to Pick Quality Shares.
Yeah.
And so Fevertree is a quality share.
It's a quality business.
A quality business. Okay.
Right.
Qualify.
It's a quality business in that it makes something that somebody wants. It differentiates itself from the competition, and it's growing, and it's turning those three characteristics into real money, real returns for the business. And so that ticks, you know, that ticks the sort of most important box, you know, when I'm looking at a company is, you know, is this a good business? I mean, Fevertree ticks that box, you know, hands down. And I think the issue that, you know, maybe me and lots of other people who have so far been on the wrong side of the trade is just the valuation the market has put on its shares. Very, very high valuation. It is essentially a classic example of what is known as a momentum share. It releases results. They come out, the management say things are going a bit better or a lot better than what we thought, and the share price keeps going up. And you know, you get these kind of shares where when they're in a sort of environment like this, where the trading environment is so good, then almost the valuation of the shares is of very little importance. You know, they, the story, the trading performance is supersedes everything. And people buy into it, and they buy into this momentum trade. And, you know, hats off to people who've done that. They've exploited that trend really well, and they've made a lot of money. The problem you get with a company like this is that sooner or later, the fundamentals catch up with it. You know, when you're on such a high valuation, you have to keep delivering. And if you don't deliver, then the market is incredibly brutal. And I think, you know, for Fevertree to keep delivering, if you look at, you know, dig down deeper, I mean, my book goes into a lot of numbers, but, you know, it's about actually understanding the business behind the numbers. You know, you look at Fevertree going forward and it's like, okay, how does this company keep delivering? And mainly it's about convincing American spirits drinkers to put not only put tonic water in their gin, but perhaps instead of putting Coke or Pepsi in their bourbon, to put Fevertree Coke and Cola in their bourbon. And that could be quite tough.
Yeah, I think that's something that echoes what we said on the podcast a few weeks back.
We were saying as well, encourage Americans to drink gin in the first place, because we weren't sure if they actually ever drunk gin. It's all the dark spirits.
Yeah.
But then the point Julia made was that actually gin, although it is a very, you know, quintessentially British drink, it wasn't the kind of trendy drink that it is now, even sort of 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and her view was that Fevertree has almost created that market.
Yeah.
So there is something incredibly skillful about what they've done.
Yeah, fantastic branding.
Yeah, amazing. Just can't think of anything that's done better in the last few years.
I think
one
of the founders is a marketing guy, isn't he?
Yeah. Tim Warrilow.
He's done that brilliantly.
Yeah. From the very beginning, though, because I was working as an analyst when they IPO'd, and from the very beginning of the IPO, they created this story about how they travelled the world sourcing their ingredients. And, yeah, I mean, in the back of your mind, you're like, oh, they've got a great holiday out of this business. But actually, it created this image of a really premium brand, which clearly has worked.
Yeah, I think the other thing as well, which is obviously the big unknown, and it sort of feeds back, you know, when you get these businesses that are so good, so profitable, it's going back to sort of textbook type stuff, but you know, it attracts, these sort of things attract competition, and you think, oh, these guys are making big fat profits selling tonic, maybe I should make some tonic as well. And when, you know, when you're selling something that's what, getting on close for what, 3.50, 4 quid a litre in your local corner shop, and you've got Schweppes down the other end, which is like, you know, £1.25, you've got plenty of room in the middle to come in. And I think the thing about this, and this is what I say, you know, it's about getting behind why these companies are so profitable, is that one of the things that Fevertree has been so successful and its profits so good is because it outsources its production to independent bottlers, distributors. Somebody else can do that. And, you know, if you look at the history of drinks, you know, when I first started out as an analyst a long time ago, one of the things I looked at was Bass Brewers, which morphed into Mitchells and Butlers and Intercontinental Hotels. And this is when Hooch Lemonade and Hooch Alco Pops.
I remember I drank an enormous amount.
Yeah. And they were a massive, massive part of Bass Brewers' profits. And nobody drinks them now. I'm not going to say that tonic's going to go the same way, because I don't think it will. But I think one of the whole things about investing is you invest in a company and you just have to keep watching it. You have to try and keep what's going on with the market to see something which currently looks good can stay good.
Well, especially something that's been driven by a trend and a change in a trend. I mean, you know, I look at Fevertree. We talk about Fevertree a lot on this podcast. Mm. Maybe we're a bit
so
obsessed with
though.
Gin. And tonic,
that's
of
fair.
Course. I'm more obsessed with the gin than the tonic, but there you go. But Schweppes, I mean, my brother runs a bar.
Yeah.
And obviously Fevertree is what everyone wants, but Schweppes are fighting back. Schweppes is a big company. Schweppes have the firepower to do that. And I fully agree with the point that you make about there's a lot of ground in the middle for someone to come into. Turns of the cover feature, written by Todd Wenning, who we both know.
Yeah, yeah.
Good old Todd. He talks about moats a lot, something Warren Buffett also is a big fan of. What is Fevertree's moat?
I think it's in the branding. It has done a very, very good job. And I mean, you know, brands are one of the biggest examples of a moat. And it's
they're not the strongest moats, because somebody else can come along
well,
with some
see.
Great branding.
No one's come along yet.
Yeah,
but I mean, what they've done is, you know, they've got inside, particularly in the UK, they've got inside the minds of premium drinkers, craft gin drinkers, saying, "Look, this is your drink of choice," and they've done that really well. Now, I think one of the things that surprises me is that, you know, Schweppes and the firepower that they've got, they seem to have been incredibly slow off the mark in actually going after that.
Mm.
You know, which makes you think, you know, what's going on? And I think Schweppes' fight back's been pretty weak, actually.
So far it has.
I tried their new, what was it, 17-something, 1783
yeah.
or something, is it? And it's, you know, same price, same sort of stuff as Fevertree. And
I still maintain I'm more interested in the gin. So.
But gin's another thing. I mean, you know, what's premium about gin when, you know, I can see, you know, where's the barrier to entry in craft gin, you know?
Well, that's true. There are a lot of craft gins. I made some gin.
Did you? The Adams Factory?
I went to the Adams Distillery. Made myself.
They have so many different types of gin.
They launched a new one while I was there. It's not that many.
Five.
This is the thing, though. And
I always thought there was one gin. Gin.
You can.
It's all about botanicals.
We could probably knock up a gin in the kitchen in the afternoon if we were out of some skill. But
couldn't sell it, though.
No, couldn't sell it. But it's and again, that's key. But, you know, it's not like premium scotch that you have to lay down for 10, 12 years. It's quicker. It's quicker to market.
It's a fair point, and that's why we've got you on board, Phil, because, you know, you were a pubs analyst at one point, weren't you?
Long time ago, yeah.
Long time ago.
Like everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else did you cover as an analyst?
I've done quite a lot. I mean, I started off at pubs, hotels, transport, and I did utilities for a bit, and that was in my sort of first 2 or 3 years. I was more of a sort of general analyst, and then when I got my job in the city, I did transport. Bus rail, ports, car rental companies. I did food retail for a bit. And then spent the last sort of half of my career doing small, medium engineering support services type companies. So quite varied.
Indeed, and you wrote some pieces for us, actually. So when you were at SharePad, which is where you've been before you were here, you wrote some pieces for us while you were there.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of pieces for them, but Outsource was a good one you did for us. I think Carillium is the one that sticks in my mind
for that on your web pages.
You got stick for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got the stick later when it went bust. But you called it.
I don't know whether I called it, but I think hopefully what you could see, and I think one of the things I liked, you know, my aim, I think, is to show particularly private investors that you can, with a little bit of effort, and if you've got very, very basic math skills, that you can pick up these things. You know, you could have looked at something like Carillion's cash flow statement, and you could have done a calculation quite quickly to realize that this business wasn't producing the cash to pay its dividend.
Mm.
And that the only way it was paying it was selling off stakes in public-private partnerships, equity stakes in public-private partnerships, and they run out. And interestingly, the year after most of those have sold off, there's a problem. And it's not, you know, it's not trying to be wise with hindsight. I think that this is the problem of the kind of the industry that we work in. It is very story based. It's universally bullish, and if you're a naysayer, you get lots of muck thrown at you.
Mm.
But I think, you know, the key thing is that if you are an investor, then what's going to see you right over the long run is avoiding big blow-ups in your portfolio, because they are very, very hard to recover from. So it's not just about picking good shares. It's about avoiding the bad stuff as well. In fact, it's even more important to avoid the bad stuff.
Yeah, so you're going to be writing a weekly column for us.
Yeah.
Amongst other things. But what sort of stuff are you going to be writing? Got any thoughts yet?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, carry on a lot of... I mean, for those people who sort of know what I do, I'll be keeping a lot of this theme of identifying good businesses, looking at trends within those types of companies. I think one particular thing that I find interesting at the moment is how high the valuation is of a lot of these perceived quality shares. So I think that's a sort of sneak preview to what I'm going to be writing next week. And then, you know, looking at individual companies, and also things like techniques, educational stuff that the private investor can use to hopefully make better investment decisions.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you.
Before we sign off, let's quickly talk about your second feature. We alluded to the cover feature, which is, as said, written by Todd on digital moats. But you wrote the next instalment of our Finding the Cure series. Mm-hmm. God, we've done loads now, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we've done seven.
Is it seven?
Mm.
This one, now, we talked about IQE as something we struggle to get our heads around. Gene therapy.
I mean, I get it more than...
You get this more than IQE.
I do get it more than IQE, but I do appreciate that a lot of people don't. It is just so mind-boggling. The thing I find mind-boggling is how these ideas come about in the first place. The thing that's really hot in gene therapy at the moment is something called CRISPR. And this is something that it's a couple of people, really, in this whole world have thought, right, I think there's bacteria who can do something really cool with virus, and they can snip it all apart and they use that to fight disease. So I think we'll use that in human therapy. That is just phenomenal science.
So this is taking out bad DNA, putting in good DNA.
Yeah,
essentially.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line, that's what it is. And it's incredible that it can be done so quickly and with such fantastic results as well. It really is the future of medicine. Commercially, it's not quite there yet, though.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing. So this sounds great. This sounds like we are genuinely at something where finding the cure is exactly what it is.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's going through clinical trials quite quickly from the sound of things, perhaps too quickly for some people's liking.
Yeah.
And this all sounds great. Mm-hmm. But there is a downside, which is if you cure a disease, you don't have that aftermarket for lifelong medicine.
Exactly. And that's what the problem is. The market for pharmaceuticals has become so big because if you give preventative medicine, you're treating patients throughout their life. And if you get diagnosed with asthma, that could be 50 years of treatment that you're getting from someone. If you cure their asthma, that is one treatment. That's it. That's all the money you're getting from that patient. And that's not a great business model. So curing disease actually is not great for pharmaceutical companies, which is shocking. It's awful.
It's a shocking thing to think about.
It's a horrible thing to think about. But it is the problem with business medicine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a very interesting chart that you've got here, which is the revenues of two leading gene therapies.
The only two.
The only two.
Yeah.
And the revenues of a... It's a respiratory.
It's an asthma treatment.
Treatment.
So it's GSK's newest asthma treatment. It's called Nucala. It's been commercial. It's been on the shelves for the same amount of time as these two gene therapies have. And I mean, we were having a discussion earlier in the week about how we put this chart together because you can barely see one of the drug revenues on the chart compared to Nucala because it's so much bigger.
And this is despite the fact that these treatments, these gene therapies, they're sold for, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars per treatment.
So the one that has the lowest revenue, it's a cure for blindness. It's a genetic form of blindness. And it costs $475,000 per eye. And I mean, you want both eyes done. So
you're paying
almost £1 million for your sight to restore your sight.
I don't have that.
No. Brilliant. And very few people do.
I'll have some of that.
Cough up. So I guess the thing here is, you know, how do you make these mass market without destroying the pharmaceutical industry?
Exactly, this is the question.
Fund the R&D.
No one knows the answer to at the moment, and this is why these companies are having to put massive price tags on their drugs, because if they're only going to be used once, you have to recoup the cost of R&D somehow, and the only way they're doing that is by making them so expensive. But then it also means that not very many people can actually buy them, and the NHS isn't going to prescribe them. I mean, I know the UK is a much smaller market compared to the US, but insurers aren't covering them. It literally has to be out of your own pocket, and that's not how the healthcare industry has evolved in the last 100 years.
This sounds like disruption.
Yeah, it is. It's massively disruptive to how the healthcare industry is and how it operates at the moment, and it's one of the reasons why there are so many problems around drug pricing in America at the moment. It's also another thing that's adding to the NHS conundrum and universal healthcare, and how are we going to provide everyone with curative treatments, which costs nearly £1 million.
I guess it's also one reason why we're struggling in some respects with the large pharma companies in the UK. You know, are they worth investing in anymore?
I'm finding it a really difficult question, because we have very few big pharma companies. We have a lot of mid-sized pharma companies, but we really only have two global giants. And they've both kind of become these global giants because pharma was a defensive stock and it was a fantastic company to invest in for dividends. But now both GSK and AstraZeneca are really high-risk companies because, well, especially AstraZeneca, they're relying so heavily on a few treatments in the future. And it's just not nearly as reliable as pharmaceuticals used to be.
I guess the same is true of a lot of, we wrote about it recently, defensive, you know, what's a defensive share anymore?
One of the things I always sort of, you know, in a very sort of simplistic view with these drug companies is, are they worth sort of more dead than alive type thing, that, you know, they're investing all this money and their payoff is so uncertain that actually, are they potentially worth more if they just stopped investing completely and just ran the patents off? I mean, that's always been a discussion that, you know, has been had. And obviously, that's not the image that the companies want to portray, but there is, you know, huge amounts of cash flow going into these into research and development, and whether that's going to pay off is, you know, is very, very uncertain. And it's, you know, and the point that was touched on a few minutes ago, has the customer, whether it be an individual or the government, got the cash to pay for it?
Well, I think we'll be pondering that question for years.
But there are a few companies in the UK that you can get access to gene therapy, to the future of medicine, and we've picked those out in the article. So all hope is not lost in pharmaceutical investing in the UK.
Interesting about these companies, that they don't have any kind of legacy business to protect either, so they can just go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is quite interesting.
And some of them are going for it really, really hard as well, and they're spending an awful lot of money, but it's all very exciting.
Yes, indeed it is. Okay, we're running up against the clock now. So thank you, Phil, and welcome to the Investors Chronicle. Thank you, Megan. And thank you, Alex, and farewell. Good luck in Spain. What else have we got in the magazine this week? We have a sector focus on the travel and leisure industry, which is quite interesting, given that everyone will be coming back for their summer holidays now. Or not, as the case may be. Yes, Megan, you put a sad face. Or not, as the case may be. Many people have seemed to have stayed at home, like we did. Algae Hall Stock Screen looks at British disruptors, whereas Todd's cover feature looks at US disruptors and the digital moats that protect them. Lots in the personal finance and funds section that they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. All the usual comments from Chris and Simon and Nicole, and from next week, Phil. Excellent. Thank you very much for listening. And pick up the magazine, Digital Champions, How to Profit from Disruptive Technologies. We'll be back in next week. I won't. I'll be in New York. Speak soon.